Persecution, trial, and tribulation. The Church of God the Eternal presents the number 15 tape in this series of vital interest and intense concern to every Christian. This message will be given by Mr. Raymond Cole.
We have already covered a goodly number of the Hebrew texts, and according to my notes, we concluded with one of the Hebrew words involved in this, which is the, let me get the word here very quickly, the word Tzaph, T-Z-A-P-H, remember is an anglicized spelling, T-Z-A-H-R-A-P-H, a Hebrew word meaning trial. Well, now we're moving very quickly then into another one that has to do with trial. This time, however, the word is tribulation. The word tribulation, not always translated tribulation, but the word itself means tribulation, which is the word T-Z-A-H-R, tsar. T-Z-A-H-R, now that is not the exact Hebrew spelling. That is an anglicized spelling of the Hebrew. And what's the use of my giving you the exact points and consonants of the Hebrew? Wouldn't mean a thing to you. So what you want is the anglicized approach. It would sound something basically like tsar, T-Z-A-H-R. It's used principally as enemy, enemies, adversary, or adversaries. Now remember, the word is tribulation, but it is frequently used in the matter of enemy, because an adversary is always an enemy, is it not? But remember how Jesus Christ was tried. Was not his adversary Satan the devil? Wasn't that an enemy? And yet by an enemy you can be tried. And very frequently God allows the enemy to do it for our good. He knows ultimately the enemy is going to be punished. There isn't any question about it. Just like the enemy of the people of God in the last days, which happens to be Assyria, if you remember in, what is it, the 10th chapter of Isaiah? And he's going to allow Assyria to do certain things as an enemy to Israel. But then ultimately God is going to intervene and is going to punish that nation for having done such a vile and filthy thing, as will transpire. So we may have enemies, but God is going to allow the enemies because he intends for us to be able to weather all the experiences which we encounter. And the enemies are varied and most diverse. The greatest enemy of mankind is Satan, but second is you. The second worst enemy you possess is you, your nature, your mind. We shall prove all that as we go along, not in this particular situation, that's going to come later on. But then thirdly, society. And then fourthly, It would indubitably be maybe neighbors or individuals, whomever they may be. And then I would say, probably fifthly, it may be your jobs or whatever, or circumstances with which you are confronted. So there are at least five avenues that you can be plagued and troubled. And you're going to encounter it left and right, because can you get out of the fabric of society? Then you're caught right in the web of it, aren't you? Is there any place you can go and flee from Satan the devil or his cohorts? They're everywhere. Is there any place that you can go and flee from yourself? You know, a lot of people think, I've got problems here. I'm going to pick up and go. I'm going to move back to the Midwest. The biggest problem you're going to take right with you. You. So you cannot change geography and whip your problems. But you can look them square in the face and begin to deal with them. So the word is used primarily as enemy or enemies or adversary or adversaries. For a cross-reference purpose, we're going to later on see or observe under the term enemy. But we're probably not going to cover that in this series. But in the overall work that I will do with respect to these words, and they may be published later on as study papers, in which all this material will be put down in a technical form or fashion. In that set of circumstances, then, you will find the cross-reference material. All right, let's notice the usage then, as it applies specifically to us. In Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter, and let's begin in verse 25. The first principle that we're going to think in terms of is modern Israel, that is Israel today, will go into captivity into the hands of enemies. And if you will remember now, the Bible says in at least three different places, and if I were to use an inferential approach, then I could probably find 50 of them. But three very specific locations tell you that those things which were written aforetime were written for our admonition and our learning, upon whom the ends of the world are come. So what was written with respect to the nation of Israel is strictly and specifically applicable to spiritual Israel, the Israel of God, as Paul was inspired to write to the Galatians of today. So those things then are for us. And what we're going to read in Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter, is applicable to us. Because man is not going to live by bread alone, but by every word which proceeds out of the mouth of God. Deuteronomy proceeded from the mouth of God. And thus spake the Eternal is used over and over and over. Therefore, if you are Christians today, called and chosen of Almighty God, you're going to live by the principles of Deuteronomy also. It's either that, or we have to deny the verity of the Word of God from the very lips of Jesus Christ himself. So in Deuteronomy, the fourth chapter, let's begin in verse 25. Deuteronomy 4, and beginning in verse 25. And I'm like some, I'm going to have to get the extra sight pieces out. Deuteronomy 4 and verse 25, when thou shalt beget children and children's children, and you shall have remained long in the land, and shall corrupt yourselves, and make a graven image, or the likeness of anything, and shall do evil in the sight of the Lord thy God, to provoke him to anger. Now it is interesting, brethren, that he shows here, it normally is a matter of time. Time, you know, there is a flush of first love. When we find God's truth, we come into it, you know, how enthusiastic and how buoyant and determined we are and so on. But that isn't a proof of a great deal. The proof is in continuity. Remember what Jesus Christ said in John 8 and verse 31? You are my disciples if you continue in those things which I have given unto you. Christianity is not a flash in the pan at the moment of conversion. True Christianity is verified in continuity, faith or conviction. If we can hang on, despite all the adversities and trials of our unique experiences, we prove that kind of character. Do you know why it is classed as character and why God has set things up in that manner? Because God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. God, because he's perfect. You can't improve on perfection. There is absolute continuity. And it is the fundamental or the underlying principle that finally compelled me to emphatically believe in the holy days and all the other statutes and the judgments of God. Because if Jesus Christ at any time, by his first appearance, changed any of the old structure, then God is not God. There's no continuity. What he did was change our approach to it so that we could faithfully abide by it. He never changed the laws. They became more valid, more binding, and more absolute. If God changed any of that relationship, he is not God. And why should I serve another human being? Human beings can change. They move all over the chessboard. But we're not here to serve human beings. We're here to serve God, and God does not change. And that principle alone is the thing that first pulled me out of the Church of God in Seventh Day into the belief of all the principles of that old covenant relationship. And what most people don't understand is the old covenant did not have anything initially to do with the matter of sacrifices and of these meal offerings and so on. Not at all. It was something that was added later, and that they have to come to understand. Well, the interesting thing here is he is saying, notice it, when thou shalt beget children and children's children, and you shall have remained long in the land. In other words, after you've grown tired of doing these things, do you still have the character and the determination to be faithful and loyal regardless? Can we keep alive first love? You shall have remained long in the land and shall corrupt yourselves and make a graven image or the likeness of anything and shall do evil in the sight of the Lord thy God to provoke him to anger. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that you shall soon utterly perish from off the land whereunto you go over Jordan to possess it. Now, we all know that we're talking about the historical type, the inheritance of the land of Canaan. But let's see if the specific application is for Israel in that day or if it is for a time far removed from the initiation of that covenant relationship. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day, whoever the you is, that you shall soon utterly perish from off the land whereunto you go over Jordan to possess it. You shall not prolong your days upon it, but shall utterly be destroyed. And the Lord shall scatter you among the nations, and you shall be left few in number among the heathen, whither the Lord shall lead you. And there you shall serve gods, the work of men's hands, wood and stone, which neither see, nor hear, nor eat, nor smell. But if from thence thou, the same people now, you shall seek the Lord thy God, you shall find him, if you seek him with all your heart and with all your soul. Somebody at some time, far removed from the day of that original covenant relationship with Israel, is going to become involved again. And if they seek God with all their hearts and with all their minds, they're going to find him, and something unique is going to happen. If thou shalt seek him with all thy heart and with all thy soul, when thou art in tribulation, and all these things are come upon you, even in the latter days. Here is a prophecy of the prophet Moses, that somebody was going to exist in the last days who are the seed of ancient Israel. You, Israel. And they're going to go into captivity. Even in the latter days, But he said, now, if they should seek him, they're going to find him. If they seek him with all their hearts and with all their minds. Even in the latter days, if you turn to the Lord your God and shall be obedient unto his voice. Now, it says in verse 30, when thou art in tribulation. Meaning, since the word primarily is used with respect to enemy or enemies, it means when they have gone under the control of their enemies. Now, nationally speaking, I don't think we have any questions on that, do we? The enemies of Israel are going to subjugate them. And they're going to go down. But who is the Israel of God upon whom this principle comes to pass in a spiritual sense? Because the Christians are the ones that are going to live the full principles of the Bible. As it is true physically, so it will be true spiritually. That's the reason you can count on it. That's the reason that manifestations are absolute. How did Christ manifest himself in the flesh? Then when we see the manifestation of God in Christ, in the flesh, the Word of God manifested in the flesh at that time, then we know exactly how he's going to manifest himself today. Don't we? Because there is no change in him. Anyone who says, oh, but you don't do what Christ did, is only kidding himself. Because Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And if he's going to live in you today, and if he isn't living in you, then you have no hope. He's going to be living in you exactly the same as he did in his own flesh body when it was manifested some 2,000 years ago, or approximately 2,000 years ago. All right? What we are saying then is, however it manifested itself physically, so shall it also manifest itself spiritually. Then what happened to them physically is precisely what's going to happen spiritually. Now, if we had understood this a long time ago, well, maybe we did, in a dark secret sense, I don't know, that the same thing was going to happen to the church. Because who was the Israel of God in the last days? It was the church. And I can read that to you in many ways. And God said then it was going to go into captivity, out of which they're going to be called one of these days. And almost the whole of Revelation bespeaks that principle. All right, the second point, so we can move right on along here. The adversaries of Israel may be victorious, but only temporarily. For what reasons? Let's notice Deuteronomy, the 32nd chapter. Deuteronomy 32, and beginning in verse 27. And here, Moses, and perhaps in this case Joshua, I don't know, you know, it's a big argument about who wrote the latter few chapters of the book of Deuteronomy. Did Moses pen his own death? Or did Joshua write, whatever it would have been, from about the 27th chapter on, I believe. Anyway, there's some question as to the last few chapters of the book of Deuteronomy. Did Moses write them or did Joshua? Well, what difference does it make, you know, whoever wrote it? So if Joshua wrote it, all right, Joshua. If Moses wrote it, then it's Moses. But whomever, let's see what they had to say concerning this very principle. Were it not that I feared the wrath of the enemy, there it is. Were it not that I feared the wrath of the enemy, that is, the adversary or the one who tribulates, lest their adversaries should behave themselves strangely, and lest they should say, our hand is high, and the Lord hath not done all this. Now, many times, and you will remember, once again, reverting to the historical example, or maybe I should say the prophetic example of Isaiah, the 10th chapter. Remember, God himself is the one who has allowed the circumstances to come to pass upon the physical nation of Israel and allowed Assyria to begin to dominate them, to take over, to control. And then they lift themselves up in a haughty, arrogant spirit, if you will recall. And they meaneth not so, but it is in their heart to do such and such, you know, and so on. And they get very arrogant, and they say, mine hand hath done this, and I've done that, and I've done something else. And finally God intervenes and said, you forgot that I'm the one who sent you and who did these things. You see, the one thing the world had to come to recognize, and this is a principle we have known for many, many years, in the case of Nebuchadnezzar, was that God himself rules supreme in the heavens, that he sets up over the nations whom he pleases, he deposes, and he imposes. In other words, he sets up and he gets rid of. God has is effectively running, oftentimes by express permission, the affairs of mankind today. Whatever is happening is by the express permission of God today. He's allowing it. Now, I'm not saying, you know, that God is the author of all this wretchedness that's going on. What I said is that they're not doing it without the permission of God. The one thing we as human beings must come to learn is that God still rules supreme in the heavens, and that Satan hasn't gained any advantage over him. All that's going on out here in the world hasn't rendered God helpless. He is expressly permitting it for specific reasons, and the times are foreordained or predetermined. And then certain things are going to happen. Now, the Assyrians of the last days, whomever they may be, are going to rise up physically and I think also spiritually, meaning Gentiles, both against the nations of Israel and also against the church. The enemy of the church of the last days. Well, we're not going to get into that part of it right now, but we'll find out who they are. And it's always been interesting to me, ever since I began to understand many of these things, that, right from the beginning, we saw the historical application. And so the finger was always pointed at the Catholic Church. Why? I think the reasons are obvious. The Catholic Church is the continuation of the physical church of the first century. But if prophecy is going to repeat itself in the last days, both physically and spiritually, then there has to be a spiritual application in the last days with respect to the church also. Otherwise, prophecy is not a repeat at all. And that which was written beforehand is not written for our admonition and our learning. All we got to do is say, no, it doesn't happen to us. That's history. And you know, it's amazing how many people get away from obedience to God by pointing a finger backward and saying, well, that would belong to so-and-so. That's how they get out from under it. But the Bible is written for the Christians today. How much of it? All of it. Well, the only way that it can be applicable today is if it applies today. Now, that's a merry circle, but nonetheless, it's absolute. So it is then a valid principle in our lives today because the totality of it relates to our time. So he said now, notice it. Were it not that I feared the wrath of the enemy, this Tsar, T-Z-A-H-R, lest their adversaries, in this case not enemy here, it is their adversaries. The term their adversaries is the word T-Z-A-H-R, should behave themselves strangely, and lest they should say, our hand is high, and the Lord hath not done all this. Knowing and understanding that people, if they're not cognizant of God, think that they do what's going on. Just like the nations are going to think they have will to do whatever is taking place today. But God himself has expressly allowed or permitted the nations today to do everything they're doing. Or in some cases, even engineered it. As I said, it was essential for Nebuchadnezzar, and remember what happened in Daniel, is distinctly a type for us today. And what Nebuchadnezzar had to learn was that God rules supreme in the heavens and does all these things. You know what human beings are going to have to learn today? That same God rules. And what's going on out here is the express will and permission of God. He's allowing it because he's set up, and you know the Bible even makes it very clear that in some cases he has even set up over these nations the worst of human beings. Now, if you don't understand the will and the purpose of God, you can ask a lot of things. And and especially if you view things as religionists do today, you would certainly have to ask about the integrity of Jesus Christ. Because Christ himself said of Judas, if you will remember, in the 18th chapter of John, "Yeah, I know whom I have chosen, but that the scripture might be fulfilled, I have chosen so-and-so." He knew at the time he chose Judas of his potential. Now, according to religionists today, you'd have to ask, well, why in the world didn't he choose someone that he thought would make it through? Because there is a will and a purpose of God, and that will is going to be carried out. I can give you many, many examples of that, even with respect to the church of the last days. Foreordained. God allowed it. You know, if something is foreordained and that the scripture cannot be broken, then it's got to happen. Isn't that true? Then certain people crept in unawares, foreordained to this condemnation because God willed it. For what reason? That those who are ultimately to make it, now not that the others won't ultimately come through, I don't read anything in the Bible that says Judas is never going to make it. None was lost initially, I understand that, except the son of perdition. Now, maybe he's finished, I don't know. I just haven't read where God said that's it. If it is, then judgment has already been passed, and I don't find any judgment that has been passed. I'll leave that up to God. But in other cases, God is using certain outsiders to do certain things with you. And in other situations, by tribulation, those who have become the catalysts of your own training will be brought back and come to see and understand God's truth. You know, one of the great and glorious and marvelous things, despite the fact that it has to be through tribulation, is the fact that many of them are going to come back to the truth of God through that tribulation. And it is going to happen. So, now, let's look at it once again. Were it not that I feared the wrath of the enemy, lest their adversaries should behave themselves strangely, and lest they should say, "Our hand is high, and the Lord hath not done all this." For they are a nation void of counsel. They're not aware of the will and the purpose of God. Neither is there any understanding in them. Oh, that they were wise, that they understood this, that they would consider their latter end. When is the latter end of the nation of Israel? You know, they didn't just die out. So their latter end has to be the last part, doesn't it? It's at least today, if not sometime clear on down in the future. Because time hasn't come to a conclusion yet. And the latter days mean the last days of the time appointed by God. So therefore, it obviously has to, at the very minimal, it has to be this time. It could be yet future, that I understand. But it certainly can't be on back 3,000 years ago. So it's in their latter days, and it applies both physically and spiritually. How should one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight, except their rock had sold them and the Lord had shut them up? How in the world is it possible for anybody to disrupt the intent and the purpose of God with respect to the nation of Israel what God had willed and what God had purposed are with the church, either of the first century or of our day, except God had allowed it. You know, one of the most significant things, and I think one of the most awesome, when I think back on it, is the scope and the power, and I'm not even sure that we as human beings understood even the beginning of the influence of that church 10 years ago. But you know, immediately after its apostasy, the whole world began to crumble. I am as convinced as it is possible to be right now that the influence was so phenomenal and so absolute in the heyday of that church which God had appointed that it absolutely swayed the behavioral pattern of the majority of human beings within Israel. Millions of them were aware of it. Why, if that is not true, then do we see that the crumbling of the entire world was synonymous with the break of the church? I mean, it began to plummet at that very time. That means its influence was a whole lot more than what we thought. It was powerful. And think what it could have been had they held on to the truth. But as God said, so it was with ancient Israel, and so it is with us today, that the aftermath of it made the people of God worse than the enemies. I mean, the enemies are learning from the people of God now in depravity. The very ones God chose. Immorality, indecency, and all the wretchedness of humanity. It is despicable. That's the way it was in ancient Israel. God said they did worse than the enemies. You know, I have a very interesting thing now, because I've been reading excerpts from this Dorothy Ruth Miller's book, Bible History in the Light of Ancient History, I guess is the title of it, something comparable to that anyway. And you know, we all understood that Nimrod, this side of the flood, initiated the old Babylonia. In other words, Nimrod was the first ruler of that. But what we didn't understand, and what I did not realize whatsoever, is that the Negroid control was extremely short. For Nimrod was Negro, you know. And the Hamitic control was extremely short, and the very people that God gave the charge and the responsibility for morality, decency, order, and that which is acceptable to humanity on the face of this earth are the ones that took over, and perversions from there began. The Japhetic peoples, the Semitic peoples took over very shortly after the establishment of that empire, and it became Semitic in its control, and she said it from that moment began a progressive decline. You know who the Semitic peoples were? They were the ones that God, because Shem, as we commonly pronounce it in the English language, was the one who killed Nimrod and who established truth on a physical plane. Shortly after his death, I don't know whether it was one generation or two generations or three generations, but a very short period of time, the Semitic peoples then took over the Hamitic control of the Babylonian Empire, and they're the ones that saw it to its wretched, debauched conclusion. Absolutely a classic historical example, because it has happened at every stage. So, would we not have expected it today? If the Bible is a history and an example, then wouldn't we have expected exactly the same thing to happen? That's the thing, brethren, we're going to have to come to recognize. And I know it's awfully hard. But that church has now become the epitome of debauchery. Is it still the church? You bet. Just like Israel is still Israel, and God set apart. And finally had to, and will bring them back, ultimately. So the church is still the church. But the true servants are going to be on the outside. That's what the Bible says, estranged brethren. Until God brings them back. And he's going to pour out his wrath upon them until they come to their senses. Until they recognize and they return. And then they're going to appeal, as the Bible plainly shows, and said, then was it better with us than it is at the present time. And that through tribulation. So here is a classic example of it in the case of Joshua, I guess in this case, Deuteronomy 32, verses 27 through 30. They're going to respond. All right, the third point is the day of judgment, God will destroy, in the day of judgment, God will destroy all adversaries of truth and of his people. Deuteronomy 32, and let's begin in verse 39. 32, beginning in verse 39. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God with me. And if you remember, Deuteronomy 32 is a prophecy. It's a long-range prophecy. See now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God with me. I kill, I make alive, I wound, and I heal. Neither is there any that can deliver out of my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven and say, I live forever. If I whet my glittering sword and mine hand take hold on judgment, I will render vengeance to mine enemies. The term enemies here, of course, is the word T-Z-A-H-R, tsar, and will reward them that hate me. Now, who is it that hates God? Those that turn from God, whether physically or spiritually. Let's not limit it at all. Any that turn from God who hate God and turn from him. I'm going to reward them that hate me, and I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh, and that with the blood of the slain and the captives from the beginning of revenges upon the enemy. You know, the interesting thing here is that this word revenges is the word that means long hair. Called enemies. The long-haired enemies of the eternal. Rejoice, O you nations, with his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants, and will render vengeance to his adversaries, T-Z-A-H-R once again, and will be merciful unto his land and to his people. So in a physical sense, then God is going to bring his people back, he's going to be merciful to them, and he's going to render the just deserts to the enemies of his people, both physically and spiritually. But it is also going to involve all people who have turned away from God, though momentarily. In other words, if they have turned in defiance and rebellion against God, if they have apostatized, if they've turned away from the truth which God once gave to them, they're going to be brought back. And this time, because they are the enemies of God's truth, of God's way of life, and they're going to be brought back through tribulation. Here is an extremely long-range prophecy assuring us of the intent and the purpose of God. Now, in the same respect, and remember the subtitle here is, the day of judgment, God will destroy all adversaries of truth and of his people. Now, it doesn't make any difference whether they're people who once understood or whether it's on the physical plane. Because, as I said, you cannot have the one if you don't have the other. If you're going to have, since the Bible relates to us and is an example for us today, then the historical example also has to apply spiritually. So if you don't have a spiritual example, neither do you have a historical. If you don't have a historical, neither do you have a spiritual. It's that plain and simple. So therefore, if his people today, the Israel of God today, is the church, then as it applied to the nation of Israel, which is the church of God, physically, so it will also apply to the physical church of God today that departed from the truth. Otherwise, the Bible doesn't make sense. In other words, it's not consistent, and it's not relevant. And how in the world are you going to live by it? How is it applicable to us today? How is it that man is going to live by every word which proceeds out of the mouth of God if it's all historical and is not applicable in our time? See, it doesn't make sense. Then the thing is, it was written for you and me. So it says then clearly that the people of God, and who are spiritually the people of God today, was a church, wasn't it? Or is he still dealing nationally? Of course not. Then as it was his, or as they were his people nationally in times of old, so the church then became his people of the latter days. They both has a physical dimension, and they also had, well, let's say in the latter days, had a spiritual dimension. But as it applied then to the church physically in the case of ancient Israel, so it will also apply to the physical church in the latter days. It has to. And that makes the Bible then relevant. Now let's notice Job 32. Job and the 32nd chapter. Concerning this same principle of God's judgment, or the day of judgment of God, which will destroy all adversaries of both the truth and of the people of God themselves. Job, the 32nd chapter, and let's begin in, Job 38. I don't mean 32 at all. Job 38. And now I want us to notice first verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, and so the principle that I want you to get here is that God is speaking. It is God himself. And what is he saying now? Well, I want to jump down very quickly to verse 19, beginning in verse 19, and we'll read through verse 28. Where is the way where light dwelleth? And as for darkness, where is the place thereof? What is the spiritual definition of light and darkness? The truth of God is light, and darkness is that which characterizes the kingdom of Satan the devil. So what is he asking? Just the same as there, the day itself has a period of darkness as well as a period of light. And we are told that at the return of Jesus Christ, the day dawns. But we're also very specifically informed that the night is far advanced. So a day in itself characterizes the entire plan of God, God's purpose. The darkness itself characterizes that span of time of 6,000 years in which men have been under the domination of Satan the devil, the kingdom of darkness. And the arising of the sun, the dawning of a day, characterizes then the coming of Jesus Christ and the establishment of a world-ruling order under the glorious principles of light. So here Job, understanding that, well, actually it's God speaking to him in this case, said, where is the way where light dwelleth? From whence does it proceed? Well, even physically, how many of us can grasp or understand that? You know, I understand that light comes in packages or particles, according to, you know, the light theory now. If you've read a great deal about it from science, that light is a matter of particles. It comes in little packages. Well, you know, that's nice terminology, but how many of you know what it means? I have no conception of what it means. Neither do they. All we know is when the sun comes up, we've got light. But you and I also know that you don't have to be too far removed from a light bulb until there's no light whatsoever. So it has an extreme limitation. So God is saying here, where is the way where light dwelleth? See, Job didn't understand, and I'm sure science doesn't understand today either. They only think they do. But I rather suspect when we really see and understand the whole truth behind all this physical creation of God, that we're going to be as awestruck and dumbfounded as, you know, as possible to be. Where is the way where light dwelleth? And as for darkness, where is the place thereof? So what he was saying to Job was, although Job was a scientist, you know, and I'm sure was rather astute in his days, but a lot of people think You know, science is well advanced today. We know a whole lot more than they ever knew before. Well, I'm not so sure of that. You know, what does the Bible mean when it says there's absolutely nothing new under the sun? And a lot of other texts, you know, that we could quote. It may be surprising one of these days to many of us to find out that back in the days just before the flood, that they lost more knowledge than we've ever gained. That's an actual fact. You know, most of us think that we live in the lap of luxury today. But you know, they've already proven archaeologically that the palace in which Abraham lived would make our palaces today look like doghouses. That's a fact. So how much knowledge did they have before God sent them out into darkness, you know, so that because he had a time element that they could not supersede? We simply don't know. And I'm not sure that we're all that bright on everything. Now, we've learned certain things because, you know, we have subjected to certain tests and so on. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I myself was quite mystified, and let's say startlingly so, in the case of our space exploration. You know, I always kept a certain big question mark behind these distances and all the rest of these figures they came up with in science. But they did land a man on the moon. I guess they did. You know, they told us they did. I didn't go out there and see it. So we have from all the apparent indications, you know, at least they put a man on the moon, and that tells you that they had to understand something. And they've sent all kinds of pictures back with respect to Venus and Jupiter, and now wasn't it Saturn that they took pictures of here recently from Mariner 2? Incidentally, I never did hear what happened to this spacecraft that we lost out there. They couldn't find it. Lost radio contact, and they've been hunting all over trying to find this little piece of metal we have out there in the space someplace. Anybody ever hear on that? They just dropped it, so maybe they couldn't find it. It's a vast space out there. Anyway, God says, and I can't help but wonder if it isn't just as valid today as it was in the day of Job, where is the way where light dwells? And as for darkness, where is the place thereof? That thou shouldest take it to the bound thereof, and that thou shouldest know the paths to the house thereof. Do you understand it and how it operates? Knowest thou it because thou wast then born? In other words, were you back there when I made light and darkness? And I created all this physical universe? Apparently, Job, being a scientist, and they all admit that Job was a scientist of no minimal means either. A very significant and understanding chap, as they would say in England. And yet God, in the final analysis, had to deal with him and said, Job, where in the world were you when all these things took place? You know, you thought you understood this and you understood that. And you had all knowledge and so on. Find out you didn't know so much at all. And finally, Job admitted he didn't know much. He said, you know, I'd heard of you, but that's about all. But brethren, you know what God's purpose is for us today is to come to know him. And when we come to know God, really know God, you know where it puts us in our station? Very, very little. Very little. Knowest thou it because thou wast then born? Now, why in the world is God chiding Job? Because Job thought he did. No, he was a scientist. Of great significance. Or because the number of thy days is great, because you've lived so long that you've acquired all this knowledge? Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow? In other words, you were able to get right there at the beginning of it, and you found out all these things, so you know what's going on. Or hast thou seen the treasures of the hail? Why, how many of us? You know, we've got plenty of meteorologists will tell you all about snow and hail and rain. Well, I imagine we've got a God in heaven that's going to bring all of our meteorologists together one of these days and say, were you there at the time? Do you understand these things? And they're probably going to say, you know, I've heard of you, but I never knew you. One of these days. which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and war. The term trouble is the very word, which I have reserved against the time of trouble. Now, isn't it interesting that God said all these physical things, darkness, light, snow, hail, the treasures of all these things, he has reserved to a specified time. These natural circumstances out here, the rain that falls on the earth, the hail that batters many sections of the country, the snow that devastates many geographic areas, the darkness that is awesomely overpowering at times, the heat that is generated from the day, all these things reserved against that day. God is going to use all these powers which people think they understand and they think they can control. And they're all out there working on it because they think they're going to finally control it. You know, and they're going to use it either for military or for whatever, and they're going to control it to their own personal advantage. And God has reserved them, which means that they're not going to use them at all, as they think. But he has reserved them against that day of trouble. And what is that day of trouble? That's when God begins to intervene. Now, can you imagine the people who think they're going to put these great mirrors up in space? They're going to lock them together up there, you know, and begin to reflect the sun's rays right down on given sections of the country. And they say they can absolutely burn them into cinders. But can you imagine the day when God says, all right, now we'll just let you have a taste of your own medicine. And he's going to burn them right out of existence. Because the sun is going to become 7 times hotter. I want to tell you, that's going to be a warm day. A warm day. There are terrifying things coming. Terrifying things. Because men have presumed certain things. And they have forgotten that the circumstances of life, rain, snow, day and night, are all there by which we're to learn. And not to abuse and take to our own personal advantage. Which I have reserved against the time of trouble, against the day of battle and war. By what way is the light parted, which scattereth the east wind upon the earth? You see, God is saying, Job, do you know why it is that when the sun comes up, it parts this darkness, and the darkness is scattered? And now light penetrates the earth. Tell me all about it, Job. I'd like to hear. Who hath divided a watercourse for the overflowing of water, or a way for the lightning of the thunder? Who's the one that does all these things? I suppose they just normally, naturally happen. You know, that's what people think. But there isn't any source behind it. There's nothing that keeps these things in check or under control. They just kind of happen. Because meteorologically speaking, these things are set up in such a way, and they just evolve that way so that now when certain conditions prevail up in the sky, and there's a certain attraction between a magnetic force, you know, in the sky and the other contrary force on the earth, then we have a streak of lightning. And as a result of the streak of lightning, we have a bolt of thunder. Simple, isn't it? So God says, tell me all about it, Job. I'd like to hear. There's real ridicule here. Ridicule that a lot of people are going to come to experience one of these days. To cause it to rain on the earth. Why is it that when the lightning flashes and the thunder rolls, it rains? Where no rain is, on the wilderness where there is no man. To satisfy the desolate and waste ground. To cause the bud of the tender herb to spring forth, rolls out across the deserts. Hath the rain a father? Or who hath begotten the drops of dew? Where did these things come from, Job? Why is it when conditions exist just so and so, it develops a dew pattern? We call dew point, you remember. Why? Why is it that the rain falls when certain conditions exist? And what brings it to pass? Out of whose womb came the ice? You know, that's an interesting story in its own right. But from whence did this ice come from? And the hoary frost of heaven, who hath gendered it? The waters are hid as with a stone, and the face of the deep is frozen. Yes, God said, these things are reserved until that day of trouble. Till the day of God's adversity, it's going to come upon humankind. So God created these things with certain things in mind. When God created the ice, when God created hail, when God created the snow, when God created the water, when God created thunder and lightning, when God created darkness and light, God had something in mind. You know what it was? The day of man's retribution. They are the instruments of war that God will use. And let me assure you, there is no brazen man who is going to stand out and defy those forces. You want to find out how paltry and insignificant a man is? Just let a tornado go through. And no matter, you know, he may think he's the greatest. But let me tell you, he runs like mad for a cellar or something to get behind. It scares the living daylights out of him. And yet he hasn't seen anything yet. Because these things are reserved for that day of God's retribution. Now, for what purpose are they so far as we're concerned? The Bible shows there is always a dual purpose. So when the pestilence rages, when the weather is turbulent, when the conditions are adverse, it is the time for us to grow spiritually the strongest. The manifestation of faith. Do we have that confidence? If we know that God is in control, then it isn't by sheer accident that God is going to allow one of his own, because he can't control it, one of his own people to be taken by thunder or by lightning or by some other form of adversity. Of course not, brethren. Then why do we stand in fear? Even because our faith is shallow. We need to learn, brethren, and have that confidence and that assurance in God. God has a purpose behind all of these things. But we need not fear. I didn't say to be brazen. I don't say to be another Job. But we don't need to fear. Because these things have been created for dual purposes. They serve us in magnificent, beneficial ways, but they are also the weapons of war in the day of retribution for the eternal God. I'm not going to continue. I want to pick up some other very significant parts of this, because it covers so many, many significant areas, but I see the time has already elapsed. So, brethren, we're going to come back to other points of this the next time that I come up. And pick up the story right from there.
persecution, trial, and tribulation. The Church of God the Eternal has just presented the number 15 tape in this series of vital interest and intense concern to every Christian. Your speaker has been Mr. Raymond Cole.